Today, we're going to continue with our study, Jeremiah 36 and the changes in Ellen G. White's writings. When I was going to the seminary years ago, I tried to present some of the things we've been studying, some of the things, to different people in the seminary, and I ran into some trouble. And in helping me with my troubles, one of the men there, who was a teacher, gave me a copy of an Andrews University School of Graduate Studies paper done by Des Cummings Jr., March 17, 1981. He walked up in the hallway to me and handed it to me. And on page 20 of this document, they did a study on a discussion of the philosophical issues in theological education in the light of the profile of the Adventist pastor for the 80s. That's what it was called. And they did a study, and on page 20 of this study, it says, quote, "What do students say? The present Adventist seminary program, although lacking in some areas, is not bankrupt in regards to spiritual development. Edward Dower, 1980, pages 125, 126, surveyed 412 graduates from Andrews University Theological Seminary. The students were asked their responses to the following statement. Comment on how well your seminary experience provided an opportunity for Christian growth as a result of a balanced program between your personal and family worship, study program, work program, and Christian recreation, i.e., temperate Christian living." You see the idea? Comment on how well your seminary experience provided an opportunity for Christian growth as a result of a balanced program between your personal and family worship, study program, work program, and Christian education. In other words, are you growing spiritually here at the seminary? 30% of the graduates made somewhat positive to positive responses. 50% somewhat negative to negative responses. And 20% made no response. The negative response rate signals a need for change in the present approach, end quote. Doesn't it signal a need for a change in the present approach indeed? Can you get a hold of what this report said? 50% of the seminary students attending the seminary during the time of this report being given indicated that as a result of their personal and family worship and their study program and their work program and their recreation, that they were not obtaining Christian growth by attending the seminary. 50%. Now, we're not talking about laity here. We're talking about a profile of the Adventist pastor for the 1980s. Going to the seminary, and 50% of them are dying spiritually. This certainly does signal need for a change, doesn't it? The change could have come out of a deeper study of Matthew chapter 23, verses 8, 9, and 10. "But be ye not called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven. Neither be ye called masters, for one is your master, even Christ." We don't have any problem with that when it comes to discussing whether we want to assume the title of father for our ministers. But we certainly do have a problem with it when it comes to assuming the title of master or rabbi. Rabbi is what Desire of Ages, page 78, calls a doctor, specifically a doctor of theology. We've discussed the changes in the writings as it relates to the death of James White, the changes from the 1882 manuscript to the Fifth Testimonies manuscript that is currently published in 1948. We've discussed the changes that have come about in the education as a result of these deletions in the manuscript. And we've entered on a study of the history. This week I'd like us to continue if we could look at a book that was published by the president of Battle Creek College in 1900. I'd like to hand this out, a copy. It cannot be the entire book. I just can't do that. The book is called Living Fountains or Broken Cisterns by E.A. Sutherland. The book itself is 427 pages long. I'm giving you a condensation of that book, a copy of some highlights in that book as it pertains. It's hard to figure out what you're going to leave out. I highly recommend that you get this book also and read it. It has some interesting things in it. The beast and its formation, how we form the image to the beast in page 176. Talks about the cramming system, degrees, courses of study, education among the early Christians, how the champion of Rome, the opposer of the Reformation named Eck, opposes the Reformation in education, talks about Egyptian education, the source from which the Greeks got their education, and the Jews got their education from the Greeks. It talks about finance and Jesuit schools, higher criticism, lots of things in here. Memory work, prominent in papal schools. The book's got it's too rich of a source to cover all of the book, so I've tried to condense it. If you'll look at your copy, you'll notice Living Fountains and Broken Cistern, an educational problem for Protestants. Jeremiah 2, verse 13, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. It's done by E.A. Sutherland, the president of Battle Creek College, published by Review and Herald Publishing Company, Battle Creek, Michigan, 1900. So people want to talk about historical Adventism and the history of our church in education. That's what we're talking about, some of these things now. If you'll turn to page 54 in Living Fountains or Broken Cisterns, I'm just going to call it Living Fountains because we're going to have a lot of pages here to go over. On page 54, it says, it talks about the school of Abraham. The ease with which men fall into evil habits is illustrated in the history of the world after the flood. Upon leaving the ark, four families who had known God had committed to them the peopling of the earth. But evil tendencies, the results of years of acquaintance with the iniquity of the antediluvian world, gained the ascendancy. And the sons of Noah, failing to carry out the principles of true education in their homes, saw their children drifting away from God. True, the bow of promise appeared often in the heavens as a reminder of the awfulness or the awful results of sin, and telling them also of the Godfather who sought their heart's service. But again, the logic of the evil one was accepted, and men said, we shall not surely die. As a sign of their confidence in their own strength, they built the Tower of Babel. They had been scattered in the hill country, where nature and natural scenery tended to elevate their thoughts. They followed the valley and built cities in the low plains. Not more than a single century had elapsed since the flood had destroyed all things. The change was a rapid one. The successive steps in degeneration are readily traced. They chose an education of the senses rather than one of faith. They left the country and congregated in cities. A monarchy arose. Schools sprang up which perpetuated these ideas. Paganism took the place of the worship of God. The tower was a monument to the sun. Idols filled the niches in the structure. Men offered their children as sacrifices. The slaying of infants and children is but carrying out in the extreme what is always done, mentally and spiritually, when children are taught false philosophy. That man might not bring upon himself immediate destruction. The language which was confused, an education in false philosophy, thus rendered more difficult. It was from this influence, as found in the city of Ur of the Chaldeans, that Abraham was called. Although the family of Terah knew the true God, and his worship was maintained in the home, it was impossible for him to counteract the influence of the city with its idolatrous practices. So God called Abraham into the country. He was obliged to go by faith. The removal meant the severing of every earthly tie. Wealth and ease were exchanged for a wandering life. How he could make a living, Abraham did not know. How he could educate his children, he did not understand. But he went forth. Terah, his father, and Lot, his nephew, went with him. They halted at Haran, a smaller city, and remained there until the father's death. Then came the command to go forward. Out into a new country he went, a pilgrim and a stranger. Isn't that a lot like what we are faced with today when it comes to the thoughts of education? If we follow the Lord, how do we make a living? Abraham did not know. If we follow the Lord in education, how do we educate our children? Abraham did not understand. But what did Abraham do? He stepped forward and followed the Lord by faith. He didn't understand everything. You know, that's what faith is. Sometimes you can't see beyond the front end of your nose in the direction you're to follow the Lord. But you take the first step out in the direction the Lord leads, and you go by faith on what he says. That's what Abraham did. That's the problem. The education of the world appeals to the senses and the physical. And God's education appeals to the spiritual and to faith. Just the opposite. Would you turn to page 72 of Living Fountains? Discusses the education that was in Israel. Granting it clear that Israel would lead by virtue of the plane of existence upon which they stood, and that this was attained by a life of faith, it is easily seen why there was marked out for the nation a system of education differing as completely from the systems of the other nations of the world as the spiritual life differs from a purely physical or a strictly mental existence. It made it impossible for any mingling of systems to take place without the utter ruin of the spiritual. For as soon as it came down to the level of either of the others, it ceased to be spiritual and lost its power to lead. As we saw here, after the flood, it wasn't long before people were offering their children as sacrifices. Are not men offering their infants and children as sacrifices today, mentally and spiritually, when children are taught false philosophy and brought up in false education? The same thing is taking place. The children are being sacrificed to the god of Moloch, but it is more deceptive in the manner in which it is carried out. There's a result of this is the logical result of a mixture in educational systems. On page 72 of Living Fountains, E.A. Sutherland continues, should Israel attempt to adopt the education of surrounding nations, that moment her education would become papal in character, for it would then be a combination of the divine with the worldly. Notice what papal, how he thought of papal? A combination of the worldly and the divine. If a man-made theocracy, a church, and state government is papal in principle, the divine and the worldly, combined in educational systems, is no less a papal principle. Israel formed such a combination more than once, but with the results recorded in Psalms 106, verses 34 through 38. Quote, they mingled among the heathen and learned their works, and they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan. End quote. Truth and error never form a compound, although they may be mingled. This is what the problem exists in Laodicea, isn't it, by definition? Volume 2, Review and Herald, page 419 and 420, discusses the foolish virgins. They prefer the sophistries of the enemy rather than a thus saith the Lord. They are used by Satan to further his falsehoods and his darknesses. They exist in a religion that is composed of a mixture of truth plus error. And the Laodicean condition represents the foolish virgins, doesn't it? Volume 2, Review and Herald, page 419 and 420. Truth and error is something they have no trouble with. The union of the two never produces truth. The union of truth and error never produces truth. And the end is death. Truth amalgamated with error, as gold with mercury, lies dormant until released. Israel could not positively forsake her God-given forms of education without relinquishing her place as leader of nations, destined to be the head and not the tail. She immediately reversed her position when she adopted a mixed system. She adopted the mixed system and she became the tail instead of the head, didn't she? On page 84 of Living Fountains, Sutherland continues concerning the education in Israel and worldly education. These words put in the mouth of an ancient Egyptian priest speak truly the spirit of Egyptian education. An Egyptian priest says, quote, I that have seen nigh 80 years of misery, I have mastered all the arts, sciences, and religion of ancient Egypt, a land that was wrinkled with age centuries before the era of Moses. I that know both all that the priests of Chem ever taught the people, and also the higher and more recondite forms of ignorance in which the priests themselves believed, I verily know nothing. I can scarcely believe in anything save universal darkness, for which no day spring cometh, and universal wretchedness, for which there is no cure. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this death? End quote. That's what a priest had to say about his knowledge, an Egyptian priest. And yet the Jews would leave that education which offered eternal life. They would leave the living waters and they would hew out for themselves broken cisterns. They would choose instead. The Jews would leave that education which offered eternal life for this which the best educated Egyptian might acknowledge to be darkness and only darkness. It was from this that God delivered Israel. But many today, claiming to be Israel in spirit, seek still the wisdom and philosophy of Egypt for themselves and their children. Israel could not come in touch with this form of life without contamination. Nay more, she fell from her exalted state and never reached it again. Jerusalem was destroyed because the education of her children was neglected. The ceremonial law given after leaving Sinai at the beginning of that memorable march of 40 years was necessary because the nation had lost all appreciation of the spiritual in the abstract and could gain no idea whatever of God as a spirit except through some appeal to the physical senses. This condition was due to the fact that 4 generations had been subject to Egyptian education. The plan of types and ceremonies alone appealed to the mind. They could not comprehend the physical or the spiritual. They could only comprehend the physical. Later on, when Christ came at the first coming of Christ, was this still their problem? Was it their problem in regards to the matters of the law and the way they viewed law? Christ tried to explain to them the physical aspects of the law, the letter of the law that they were following, did not contain the richer meaning that was found in the spiritual aspects. He tried to show them that even if they hated their brother, they murdered him. They couldn't comprehend this. They wanted the literal physical thing. When Christ told them to take his word and bind it upon their hearts, and to bind it as a frontlet between their eyes, and he described manners in which it should be carried in the hand. He was talking about the spiritual aspect of his word, but they couldn't comprehend the spiritual. They relied on the physical, and they made for themselves phylacteries, didn't they? They took a phylactery, made broad their phylacteries. When God said, put it as a frontlet between your eyes, he meant that it should be in the foremost of their mind, the word of God. And what did they do? They made a little phylactery and stuck it between their eyes or on their wrists, a little bunch of books. And as time went by, the little bunch and groupings of books grew larger. They made broad their phylacteries. They wanted this outward physical sign to attract people to them so they could claim to be the called and chosen people of God. The phylactery consisted of an outward display of prophetic writings to attract people's attention to them as being God's chosen and called. Both chosen and called was their attitude in regards to themselves, both called and chosen as a church. Is that the same thing that happens today when we appeal through Revelations chapter 12 and verse 17 in regards to the remnant people having the commandments of God and keeping the testimonies of Jesus? And we consider that having and keeping has to do with our obedience, with being fulfilling them, with being obedient to the commandments and the testimonies, with making them full and preserving and protecting them and guarding them from loss or injury. It has to do with our obedience to them. Then when we go to Revelations 12, 17, and we stress that we outwardly own and we outwardly can point to the spirit of prophecy as being with us, we can point to our ABCs and our library shelves and outwardly say the spirit of prophecy is with us, and yet inwardly there is no heart change going on. There's no obedience, or minimum obedience being upheld to the people in regard to those same writings. What have we made for ourselves? A phylactery. Then is there any difference? And do you see where the problem comes from? A false educational system caused the Jews to neglect the spiritual and follow after the physical. Finally, it got so obtuse in their life that instead of being obedient to the Word of God, they made little books and strapped it to their bodies. Do we do any greater or any less when we take the writings of Ellen White and strap them outwardly and say that we own them? Therefore, we hold them up to the people to attract the people to us as being the true people of God, and yet we are not obedient to them. Aren't we then making a phylactery the same as the Jews did? Haven't we been trapped by the physical and lost sight of the spiritual? And yet, brothers and sisters, every time Revelations 12, 17 is taught in conference evangelism, that's the way it's misused. The outward ownership is stressed, but the inward obedience is minimized. And the having and keeping of Revelations 12, 17 has nothing to do with outward ownership. It has to do with obedience and an inward ownership, an inward possession. On page 90, of Living Fountains and Broken Cisterns, talking about the education in Israel, Sutherland continues and says, another noticeable fact is that release from bondage was always heralded by two reforms. We have some people giving cooking classes here now. This is going to be interesting to you. Another noticeable fact is that the release from bondage was always heralded by two reforms. For instance, before deliverance from Babylon, Daniel was raised up to give the people instruction in health reform and educational reform. These two always accompany each other. The one affects the body, preparing it to become the temple of the Holy Ghost. The other turns the mind toward truth. Notice, not truth plus error. It turns it toward truth, right? That the Spirit of God may think through it. A body purified by right living and a mind trained according to the laws of Christian education bring an experience such as Daniel had. That he lived on a plane above the majority of men is evident. For I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision. What to Daniel was the voice of God, those whose ears were not in tune with the infinite heard as thunder or as an earthquake. It had been the privilege of all to see and hear as Daniel saw and heard, but they chose a coarser life, a slower vibratory existence, where the mental strain was less and the heartstrings were looser. It was easier to keep in tune with Egypt or Babylon than with the God of heaven. And when the Son of Man was born, he found it hard to select even a small company whose lives were in harmony with his own. That was the first thing we see when we go to Daniel chapter 1, isn't it? When Daniel was in captivity, what did the king try to do to Daniel right away? Change his diet, change his name, and what else? Re-educate him, didn't he? Israel's education was a spiritual education. Her king was to set up a spiritual kingdom in the hearts of a people spiritualized by the presence of truth, not a mixture of truth plus error. It was the same system which had been delivered by Christ to Adam, the same by which Abraham was taught, and what was not accomplished in the past ages will be accomplished by Christian education in the days preparatory to his second coming. In Series A on page 9, Series A number 12, page 9, it says, "The science by which our first parents were deceived is deceiving men today." Now, what was that science? Did Satan come and say, "You'll be as gods, knowing good and evil"? He wanted them to value good and evil, didn't he? To mix it together and see nothing wrong with it. Is that still going on today? The science by which our first parents were deceived is deceiving men today? That's the foundational principle of papal education. Christian principles plus worldly Greek, Egyptian education. In Volume 2, Review and Herald, page 419 and 420, it says that the Laodicean foolish virgins prefer a mixture of truth and error. If you look in Living Fountains on page 101, Sutherland continues, quote, "If Egypt offered ground for the germination of the seed of pagan education, Greece brought the plant to its seed-producing state, and Rome, acting as the wind with the thistle down, scattered pagan education broadcast." But where can it be traced back to? Egypt. Of Rome, we read, "It gathered into its arms the elements of Grecian and Oriental culture, and as its end drew nigh, it scatters them freely over the rest of Europe. Rome has been the bearer of culture to the modern world," end quote. In order to understand the fertility of the seeds of pagan education, it is necessary to regard with care the mastermind of that system. And this we find in Plato. Here stand the two systems on page 108, talking about the pagan educational system, Platonism in modern schools. Sutherland says, "Here stand the two systems side by side, the one guided by human reason, the other by the spirit of the living God. Remember that the world bows to Plato, and raising its hand in an attitude of worship, lays at his feet its tribute, its dearest idol, its educational system." On page 116, Sutherland continues about the pagan educational system. He says, "Of what use is the preaching of the gospel one day of the week, while 6 days out of seven, paganism guides the intellect?" That's something to think about, isn't it? "Why sit dreaming of heaven or spend money to proselyte while pagan education leads your own children by the hand and weaves about their mind a network of theories which blinds their eyes to spiritual truths?" Pagan education blinds the eyes to spiritual truth. What is the problem of Laodicea in Revelations 3, 14 and 17? "And to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, Knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked? On page 117, Sutherland continues, talking about Christ, the educator of educators. To Israel as a nation had been entrusted the sacred gift of teaching, but the power had departed from this people because they had mingled their educational ideas with the heathen and had so far forgotten the commands of Jehovah that they were sending their children to heathen teachers, inviting into their midst the prophets of Baal, that nation whose prophets had more than once warned the kings of the earth of impending danger, heard no longer the voice of God. For nearly 400 years, no prophet had risen in Israel. Prophecy had become so completely extinct, the spirit had so utterly departed from Israel, that it was apparently assumed by many that a new prophet was an impossibility. End quote. Notice, as a result of their neglecting of the gift of teaching that God gave to them, the power departed from Israel. What's the situation of God's professed church at the time of the end? Fifth Testimonies, page 209 and 210 tells us, the chapter of the seal of God. Let me read it to you. Keep your ear out to see what happens to the power in the church, in God's professed called church during the time of the end. At the time when the danger and depression of the church are greatest, the little company who are standing in the light will be sighing and crying for the abominations that are done in the land, but more especially where their prayers arise in behalf of the church, because its members are doing after the manner of the world. The earnest prayers of this faithful few will not be in vain. When the Lord comes forth as an avenger, he will also come forth as a protector of all those who have preserved the faith in its purity and kept themselves unspotted from the world. It is at this time that God has promised to avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them. The command is, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. These sighing, crying ones had been holding forth the words of life. They had reproved, counseled, and entreated. Some who had been dishonoring God repented and humbled their hearts before him, but the glory of the Lord had departed from Israel. Although many still continued the forms of religion, his power and presence were lacking. Do you see the condition of the church, of God's professed church at the time of the end? God holds forth the words to us there and says, the glory of the Lord had departed from Israel. Although many still continued the forms of religion, his power and presence were lacking. Do you see the parallel? Do you see possible reasons why the presence of God would depart? He departed Israel because of their false educational system. When did we ever think that we could go to the prophets of Baal and teach and ask them to teach us church growth? Ancient Israel went to the prophets of Baal and asked them to teach their children. Brothers and sisters, have we gone to the prophets of Baal today? Where do we go to get our church growth program? We go to Babylon. We bring in Babylonian ministers. If you look in not too far past advertisements that come to us, periodically they're advertising a ministerial program for church growth at Andrews University. And the key speakers are theologians from Fuller Theological Seminary. Is that Babylonian? Yes, brothers and sisters, Babylonian. We bring in Baal priests to teach us church growth. That's where we have our church growth program founded from today. That's where we got it from. Are we any different than the Israelites in their appeal to the prophets of Baal to teach them things? And then what happened in Israel? They no longer saw the prophetic voice among them, did they? How many years ago was it that Ellen White died? Have we seen the prophetic voice among us in a living prophet since 1916? Do you ever ask yourself, why not? Do you know why not? Let me give you the reason. Why do you think that we don't receive visions? Why do you think that we don't have another living prophet? What do you think the Lord would tell us that would give us an indication? Fifth Testimonies, page 674, says this, quote, I saw that the reason why visions had not been more frequent of late is they have not been appreciated by the church. The church have nearly lost their spirituality and faith, and the reproofs and warnings have had but little effect upon them. We haven't had a prophet, a living prophet, since 1916. When Israel departed from the Lord, that was a characteristic with them too. A living prophet among them ceased. Why? Well, why not? What good is it if we aren't living up to the messages that have already been given? The mere fact that we haven't had a living prophet living among us should signal some kind of concern to us that we are not having the testimony of Jesus. We are not guarding it and protecting it from loss or injury or preserving it. Clearly, as this Jeremiah 36 study clearly shows. Would you turn over to Living Fountains by E.A. Sutherland on page 132? Talking about Christ as a teacher, it discusses his pupils on page 132. His actual work as a teacher is seen in his dealings first with the apostles, his immediate followers, who were in training, that they in turn might become teachers. Second, with the multitudes who thronged his way. Third, with the children who were brought to him by mothers and who were taught by him, that mothers and apostles might the better know how to deal with youthful minds. Primarily, his was a training school for workers. That's a very key principle, brothers and sisters. That's Christian education, isn't it? Christian education is a training school for workers. We are ambassadors of Christ as his workers, and we're trained how to do his work. How is that different from worldly education? Does worldly education train you to have a job and a career, or does it train you to be a worker for Christ? Is there a difference? Which is first and primary in worldly education? Self. But isn't career and job primary? Which is primary in Christian education? Doing the purity of the work of the Lord is primary, isn't it? Job and career is secondary. It's a means to do the work of the Lord. In worldly education, the job and career become the means and the end all at once. Primarily, Christ was a training for workers, Christ's school, and his pupils represented every phase of human disposition. Notice this. Last week we had the question, why do you think Ellen White was selected to be a prophet? Was it probably because she didn't go through all that pagan schooling? Notice this. Christ chose humble fishermen because their minds were unprejudiced and they had less to unlearn before accepting the truth. It's interesting, if you look about Ellen White and what the Lord said to her in one selected message, page 32, quote, my Savior declared me to be his messenger. Your work, he instructed me, is to bear my word. Then are the writings of Ellen White the word of God? According to her testimony, yes. And then she continues on. Christ is being quoted here, 1 SM 32. In the true eloquence of simplicity, with voice and pen, the messages that I give, in other words, God saying, the messages that I give, shall be heard from one, meaning Ellen White, who has never learned in the schools. My spirit and my power shall be with you, end quote. Was Ellen White selected also because she had never learned in the schools? Yes. Yes. God specifically specified in 1 SM 32, he chose here her who has never learned in the schools. Has he changed? He chose humble fishermen because their minds were unprejudiced and they had less to unlearn before accepting the truth. Then, brothers and sisters, do we not have to plead to become humble? Do we not have to have a humbleness of mind? Do we not have to put these things on? They're not natural for us, are they? A humbleness of mind is not something we're born with. We have to learn it. And if we become humble then, do we not realize that there may be things that we have to learn and other things that we have to unlearn? Unlearning things is very difficult. Christ knew what was in man. That is, he had insight into the minds and hearts and knew just what was needed to awaken the soul life of each student. Isn't that an example of Christian education? It forms upon the individual, doesn't it? What does pagan or papal education or Laodicean education do? It educates in mass, doesn't it? Christ knew just what was needed to awaken the soul life of each student. This is a necessary gift in the successful teacher. How much that is now taught would be dispensed with if teachers could read the soul conditions of pupils and then feed them with only such food as would nourish. Is that a mixture of truth plus error? No, it's only such food as would nourish. It's the truth alone. Is that the authors and the books of infidel writers? No, it's the truth, period. This too is Christian education. Before the teacher can have such an experience, however, he must have soul culture and be in such close touch with the fountain of truth that he can draw whatever is needed. The well is deep, and faith alone can bring the water of life to the surface. These thoughts, it's kind of like having E.A. Sutherland with us to get the thoughts of one of the founders of our educational program. Of course, it departed long ago from his principles, but it's nice to know that he gave us these words. On page 142, and why is it nice to know? Well, let's remind ourselves. Testimonies to Ministers, page 31, says, quote, "We have nothing to fear for the future, except as we shall forget the way the Lord has led us." That's why we're looking at some of this history. On page 142, E.A. Sutherland continues and talks about education in the early church. He says, "The tender solicitude of these early Christians for the religious instruction of their children is one of their most beautiful characteristics. They taught them, even at the earliest dawn of intelligence, the sacred names of God and the Savior. They sought to lead the infant minds of their children up to God by familiar narratives from Scripture, by Joseph, of young Samuel, of Josiah, and of the holy child Jesus. The history of the prophets and apostles, or the history of the patriarchs and the prophets and apostles, and men whose lives are narrated in the sacred volume were the nursery tales which they sought to form the tender minds of their children." What are the nursery tales used today? Fiction, myths, Cinderella, violent things too, aren't they? I can't think of some of them today. Some of them are going around. Some of them are not such playtime myths as Cinderella or some of the nursery rhyme type stories. Now today they take on a more animated, violent aspect, don't they? They have a demon and a human side that blend together, evil and good working together, take vengeance. They have all kinds of mythical creatures in cartoons today for the children to be involved in. They call this is the modern nursery tales that people are growing up with today. As the mind of the child expanded under the nursery tales that were sacred, the parents made it their sacred duty and delightful task daily to exercise him in the recital of select passages of Scripture relating to the doctrines and duties of religion. The Bible was the entertainment of the fireside. It was the first, the last, the only school book, almost, of the child. And sacred psalmody, the only song with which his infant cry was hushed as he was lulled to rest on his mother's arm. The sacred song and the crude melody of its music were from the earliest periods of Christian antiquity an important means of impressing the infant heart with sentiments of piety and of imbuing the susceptible minds of the young with the knowledge and the faith of the Scriptures. True education developed missionaries. Painter writes in his book, History of Education, on page 90, that Sutherland quotes here, "The purpose of these early Christian parents, as of the ancient Jews, was to train up their children in the fear of the God, in order that the children might be exposed as little as possible to the corrupting influences of the heathen association. Their education was conducted within the healthful precincts of home. As a result, they grew up without a taste for debasing pleasures. They acquired simple domestic tastes. And when the time came, they took their place as consistent and earnest workers in the church." These words make several facts very prominent. Four facts. Number one, Christian education should begin in the home. Number two, Bible stories should be the basis for nursery tales and infant songs. Three, Christians should carry out the plan of education which the Jews failed to obey and which Christ revealed in a new light. Four, the results of such Christian education in the home school will be elevated characters and workers in the cause of God. Would that it could be said of Christian mothers today, as a heathen orator once exclaimed concerning those earlier followers of Christ, "What wives these Christians have!" End quote. Would you turn over to page 184 of Living Fountains by E.A. Sutherland? He talks about, now we're coming up to the education of the Middle Ages. The development of the papacy led directly to the Dark Ages, for the noontide of the papacy was the world's moral midnight. The papacy was the logical working out of an educational scheme. Hence the moral darkness which spread over the world during the prophetic period of 1260 years was due to wrong methods of education. People did not sink into degradation and sin when properly educated. Truth elevates, and when embodied in man, brings him nearer to his Maker. Faith is the ladder by which he climbs, and when that element has been lacking in an educational system, the masses have sunk lower and lower. On page 185, we continue on, and he says, "In order to maintain the supremacy thus gained, it was necessary for the education of the young to lie wholly within the control of the papal hierarchy. And it is with their educational institutions and educational methods that we have now to deal. It is hoped that the study of the Dark Ages will so accentuate the importance of the Protestants maintaining their own schools that the tendency now so strong in the other direction may receive a check." Keep in mind, when was this book written? 1900. "The education begun in the schools of the early Christians has been followed into the monastic institutions of the Middle Ages. The life and power of Christianity departed, and form alone remained. It has been said that paganism in the garb of Christianity walked into the church. And it can truthfully be added that it gained admittance through the schools." On page 186, he continues, he talks about the prominence of memory work in papal education. We discussed that, haven't we? In the book of Education on page 230, we see the spiritual penalties for this type of papal memory work. He's in a complete agreement with Ellen White on that, isn't he? Note carefully that work of these children under Satan's educational system, was almost wholly memory work. They were to learn by heart and to repeat without understanding. This was the first step in that great system which binds the minds of the masses to the will of one sovereign mind. And we know how that works, don't we? Education, page 230. On page 204, talking about education of the Middle Ages, Sutherland writes, "The students lead a free and uncontrolled life, seeking and finding protection in their own university authorities, even from the civil power." Isn't that true yet today? How many people escaped going to Vietnam by going to their universities? Same thing today. That was what the students were doing in the Middle Ages, escaping civil power by running off to the universities. Youth from the age of 12 and upward attended these universities, making it necessary to teach the secondary studies, which terminated in a bachelor's degree. Boys attended the Parisian university merely for instruction in grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. And after 3 or 4 years' study, they received the title of baccalaureus. When he reached the age of 17 or 18, he then began the study for the mastership. It will be remembered that the schools established by the early church were marked for the simplicity of their methods and their singleness of purpose. Their object was to educate workers for the spread of the gospel. For the accomplishment of this object, the course of instruction was arranged, and the students were sent forth into the world commissioned of God, as were the disciples after their ordination. There was no call for the granting of degrees. Search through the education of the early church and try to find one. There was no call for the granting of degrees. These, it is true, were used in the pagan schools and indicated that the receiver had been initiated after years of study into the hidden mysteries of Greek wisdom. Among the pagans, indeed, the principle of degrees and diplomas dated back to the days of Egyptian and Babylonian supremacy, where it was indicative of fellowship in the grossest forms of licentiousness. What does licentiousness mean? Morally unrestrained, right? If you look in Fifth Testimonies, page 142, it says, there is always a bewitching power in heresies and in licentiousness. The mind is so deluded that it cannot reason intelligently. And what spawns this licentiousness? Babylonian and Egyptian universities. I could think of no better example of that than the fraternity and sorority system, brothers and sisters. The fraternity and sorority system in universities is a primary example of the whole hedonistic attitude of morally unrestrained living that I can think of. Free love, free sex, drugs, alcohol. And is it tolerated by the educators of the university? Yes, they seek to protect it many times from civil authorities. That's true. Can this even rightly or even in the remotest way be connected with Christianity? No. And where does the control come? Right down to our elementary schools. Where are they geared and what are they geared by? Those very same universities. Don't our elementary schools provide children to go to our high schools, that provide children to go to our universities? And who sets the tone? The universities. The elementary and high schools are only servants of the universities. Continuing on page 205, Greece, the country which united the learning of Babylon and the wisdom of Egypt, offered it to Europe in the form of Platonism, naturally enough made use of diplomas and degrees. And the fact that her wisdom was so complicated in its nature made it necessary to spend long years in mastering her sciences. We can remember what Testimonies to Ministers said on page 401 and 402 about her concepts of spending long years, can't we? Let me just pull out something here just to remind us. Let me just read some things from just a little bit here from long years. On page 106, 109, and 110 of Special Testimonies on Education by Ellen G. White, just as a reminder, years pass, it says, and still there is urged upon the students the necessity of more education. This long drawn out process, adding and adding more time, more branches, is one of Satan's snares to keep laborers back. That's enough said there. I think we'll get into it a little further as we go into this. It has to do with cramming, and we're going to get into that. cramming is the characteristic that we see in pagan education. Paganism, moreover, has been one model for all men. Its aim is ever to crush individuality and mold all characters alike. To accomplish this purpose, the schools arrange their studies in courses, demanding that each student should pass over the same ground. This is characteristic of all educational systems, aside from that one, the true education, which comes from God. If you look to China, you'll find it there, as it develops the disciples of Confucius. India educates her Brahmins in the same manner. The priests and wise men of Egypt were taught in schools of a similar type. The Jews had aped the fashion of the pagan world, and it was from this custom that Christ called his disciples. One of the surest signs that the schools established in the days of Christian purity had lost the spirit which characterized the apostolic teaching is the fact that the schools of the Middle Ages had adopted this pagan custom of sending children over the same ground and educating the masses. Students were called into the universities when mere boys, and by hundreds and thousands were run through the grind, which we term course of instruction, and were turned out at the end of 10, 20, or sometimes even 40 years with a degree, which in dignity corresponded to the years spent in completing the course. It is a degree, isn't it? The degree of years you've been there. This custom is papal. It is opposed to the very spirit of Christianity and any institution of learning. How many? Any institution of learning, one of our founders said. Which deigns it to accept the approval of the state while at the same time passing as a Christian institution is not only linking itself with the papacy, but with paganism as well. Of his followers, Christ says, they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Older students, those especially in the theological faculty, with their 15 or 16 years course of study, achieved in this respect far greater notoriety. At the age of 30 or 40, the student at the university was still a scholar. The idea of long courses is not then a modern one. And American colleges can truthfully point to the University of Paris for the precedent in this respect, as in many others. In the granting of degrees, another interesting subject is approached. Laurie continues, up to the middle of the 12th century, anyone taught in the infant universities who thought he had the requisite knowledge in the second half of the 12th century, when bishops and abbots who acted personally or through their deputies as chancellors of the rising university schools wished to assume to themselves exclusively the right of granting the license. Pope Alexander III forbade them on the ground that the teaching faculty was a gift of God. This, however, must have been the work of a liberal pope, for earlier, that is, in 1219, Pope Honorius III interfered with the granting of degrees, and in order to impose a check on abuses, directed that they should be conferred not by, but by permission of, the archdeacon of the cathedral and under his presidency. The church had gained control of the universities, and through her representative, usually the chancellor, granted degrees. Now, in order to keep the authority well in her own hands, no one was allowed to teach who did not hold a license granted by the university after an examination. Thus, the educational trust developed. And the iron hand of Rome, though concealed in a silken glove, clenched her victories and strove to crush all opponents. He goes on and discusses degrees in the papacy. Our modern B.S., M.A., L.L.D., D.D., etc., were adopted into the universities at this stage of educational history. Eider informs us, says Laurie, that a complete university course was represented by 4 degrees, bachelor, master, licentiate, and finally doctor. which last was usually taken at the age of 30 or 35. The next development of the degree system was the introduction of the grades of bachelor and master, or licentiate, into each of the higher faculties, theology, law, and medicine. Thus, a man who had finished his preliminary art studies, generally at the age of 21, and wished to specialize in theology, medicine, or law, had to pass through the stages of bachelor of theology, or of medicine, or of law, and then of master, or licentiate, before he obtained the title of doctor. The bachelorship of medicine or law was reached in 3 years, of theology in 7. 4 years further study brought the doctor's degree. The conferring of degrees was originated by a pope. And what was it that Jesus said in Special Testimonies of Education by Ellen G. White on page 106? Years pass, and still there is urged upon the students the necessity of more education. This long drawn out process, adding and adding more time, more branches, is one of Satan's snares to keep laborers back. The educational monopoly appeared quite complete, and having gained the form of godliness and the civil power, the old scheme of killing the life and substituting those things which would recognize the papal hierarchy were again introduced. Leading educators were awakened to the true situation Christian education alone can deliver. Discussing education, continuing with education in the Middle Ages on page 210. The moral tone of the universities was low, says Painter. There were brawls, outbreaks, and abominable immoralities. The students, say the Vienna Statutes, shall not spend more time in drinking, fighting, and guitar playing than at physics, logic, and the regular courses of lectures. And they shall not get up public dances in the streets. Quarrelers, wanton persons, drunkards, those that go about serenading at night and who spend their leisure in following after lewd women, thieves, those that insult citizens, players at dice, having been properly warned and not reforming, beside the ordinary punishment provided by law for those misdemeanors, shall be deprived of their academic privileges and expelled. These prohibitions give us a clear insight into university life of the time, for it was not worse at Vienna than at Paris and elsewhere. And what's it like today, brothers and sisters? The Laodicean church is alarmed because these same immoralities are in the increase in Laodicean schools, let alone totally worldly schools. Could some of these medieval students be resurrected and placed in some of the universities of the 19th century, and I might say the 20th century today, they might feel quite at home. Not only as far as courses of study and the granting of degrees is concerned, but in the revelings, partings, etc., judging from the reports of the hazing, drinking, and general carousing of the students in our university towns. The conduct of the student is the reflex of the instruction given. It is not, therefore, to be wondered at that the instruction of the universities, containing as it did the form without the life, should fail to develop stability of character in its students. The true Catholic attitude to all investigation was and is one admitting of great advances in every department of learning while checking all true freedom of thought. Would you turn over to page 322? We're almost finished with this little overview.
It really does sound like he's talking about those schools.
It does, doesn't it?
Sounds
like he's talking about today's school, was the comment, yes?
You find out that behavior is a result. That's interesting. We look back on our own.
And where did it all start? University of Paris, University of Vienna, schools spawned by the papal system, which have spread all through the world and have been even adopted today by modern Israel. No different than it was in the days of Christ, ancient Israel adopted the Greek system also. On page 322, we're going to discuss America and education. Sutherland writes, the multiplication of courses. And when you went to college, did you ever wonder, you know, you go to college and it seems like they're trying to drive you crazy? They give you so many college courses that it's difficult to maintain them all, isn't it? I don't care what anybody says. The load is increasing. It's exemplified by the amount of homework that even high school kids have to take home. Homework. They work all day in school and they drag home a big arm of books that night. Let's read about this here. Great changes have occurred in the 20 years since 1868 in the multiplication of courses and the accompanying specializations of study. Perhaps figures will be more impressive on this point than mere words. Boone states that of the 47 higher institutions whose reports are given by Dr. Adams, including Harvard, Columbia, and Brown, and 10 leading state universities, 46 report an aggregate, or an average, of 189 courses in history and closely related subjects. Cornell, he writes in 1900, now offers so many courses that should a student attempt to take them all, it would require more than the natural life of a man to complete them. It is not with any spirit of condemnation that these things are stated, but it can be seen by all that there is a meaning which inevitably attaches to these changes, the multiplicity of subjects. The multiplicity of subjects taught has led to a wonderful book study, and a student's whole life is spent in an attempt to put into his own head the thoughts which others have written for him. The spirit of the universities was caught by the academies and by the high schools and is reflected even in the lower grades. It is the beginning of the cramming process now so forcibly denounced by a few true educators. Notice, the cramming process tries to cram in so much information that it's difficult to even learn it in a lifetime. The cramming process, brothers and sisters, is papal. It benumbs the mind. Special Testimonies on Education, on page 109 and 110, the Lord's messenger writes, bearing his word, quote, long years of preparation are not a positive necessity. The preparation of the students has been managed on the same principle as have the building operations. Building has been added to building simply to make things a little more convenient and thorough. God is calling and has been calling for years for a reform on these lines. End quote. Special Testimonies on Education, 109 and 110. Special Testimonies on Education, page 106. Years pass, and still there is urged upon the students the necessity of more education. This long drawn out process, adding and adding more time, more branches, is one of Satan's snares to keep the laborers back. The students themselves would not think of such a delay in entering the work if it were not urged upon them by those who are supposed to be shepherds and guardians, and who are their teachers and physicians. If we had 1,000 years before us, such a depth of knowledge would be uncalled for, although it might be more appropriate. But now our time is limited, end quote. Special Testimonies on Education, page 106. That's a thought that I wanted to bring home to you. The papal educational system has a multiplicity of subjects. If you went to Cornell in 1900 and tried to take courses in history, you couldn't even complete them all in a lifetime. Now, what does the papal educational system then indirectly say? What is one of the foundation teachings of the papacy itself? Immortality of the soul, isn't it? And what does the multiplicity of subjects indirectly indicate? Compatibility with that teaching, doesn't it? What does the Lord's messenger say? If we had 1,000 years before us, such a depth of knowledge would be uncalled for. The papacy doesn't think that way, does it? They act as if you did have 1,000 years before you, because they're operating under the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, and it's reflected in their educational system in the multiplicity of subjects. On page 323, Sutherland continues, readers of our magazines are familiar with the ideas expressed by Mrs. Lou Wallace in The Murder of the Modern Innocents by the educator of the Ladies' Home Journal and others. I deem it sufficient to quote from Mr. Edward Bach, who started American homes, or who startled American homes by stating that in five cities of our country alone, there were, during the last school term, over 16,000 children between the ages of 8 and 14 taken out of the public schools because their nervous systems were wrecked and their minds were incapable of going on any further in the infernal cramming system which exists today in our schools. Has it gotten any better? Gotten worse. It was planned by nature that between the years of 7 and 15, the child should have rest. Not rest which will stop all mental and physical growth, of course, but the child's pace should be checked so as to allow him to recover from the strain which his system has just undergone. But what really happens to the child at the age of 7? Is he given this period of rest? Verily, no. He enters the schoolroom and becomes a victim of long hours of confinement. The first mental application, mind you, that the child has ever known. The nervous wear and tear begins. The child is fairly launched upon his enjoyment of the great educational system of America. Yes, that's sarcasm, isn't it? That's an example of withering sarcasm, isn't it? Acts of the Apostles, page 124. Special systems of marks, which amount to prizes, are started serving only to stimulate the preternaturality bright child who needs relaxation most of all and to discourage the child who happens to be below the average of intelligence. Now, what does Jesus say about prizes and rewards? In the Review and Herald, January 9, 1894, we have this message from the Lord. High rewards and honors as a recompense for good scholarship is to be discouraged in our schools. End quote. It is cramming, cramming, cramming that takes place in our schools. A certain amount of ground must be gone over, as it is usually called. Whether the child is physically able to work the ground does not enter into the question. Would it if it was Christian education? The individual would be considered, every individual. But the papal system goes over the same ground. A certain amount of ground must be covered, and it doesn't matter. They either make it or they're broken. That's the papal system of education. We do not stop even there. The poor children are compelled to carry home a pile of books to study, usually after supper and just before going to bed. And that is about the most barbarous part of the whole system. This is enough to show that the system is recognized as practicing methods not in accordance with the laws of nature, which are the laws of God. Such methods are the result of the system at the head of which stand the colleges and universities, which outline the work for all below them. Parents read these statements with wonder and a feeling of horror, but only a few realize that the primary schools and the grammar schools and even the high schools are responsible for the health-destroying, brain-benumbing methods employed in our public schools. Read Special Testimonies on Education, page 110, what she says about exhaustive courses of study. Goes right in line with this. Continuing on page 326 of Sutherland, Living Fountains and Broken Cisterns, the cause for the present system and methods is to be searched for in the changes which time has wrought in those simple schools planted by the freedom-seeking Puritan fathers. Say rather that Protestantism offered a system of Christian education which, if it had been followed, would have prevented what we find today. Page 342. Painter says, When a young man had acquired a thorough mastery of the Latin language for all purposes, when he was well versed in the theological and philosophical opinions of his preceptors, when he was skillful in dispute and could make a brilliant display from the resources of a well-stored memory, he had reached the highest points to which the Jesuits sought to lead him. Originality and independence of mind, love of truth for its own sake. Isn't that a problem for today? Oh, believe me. Love of truth for its own sake, the power of reflecting and of forming correct judgments were not merely neglected, they were suppressed in the Jesuit system.